Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique 3-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
So that I do not like to spend my time or money in salons when I can help it, but I do enjoy a good manicure, and I especially enjoy spending time with my daughters doing the Olive and June Mani system at home, because we can all get a good looking manicure for around $2. We know that the polish won't chip and will last at least a full week. We get to await with anticipation the new colors that come out each season. The girls love being able to add some sparkles or choose whether they want their top coat to be matte or shiny. We just have a really good time together with salon grade tools that are so easily explained so that we can do a really good job taking care of our nails, but do it all from the comfort at home. All the choices of a big salon stored in a basket in my closet for when we're ready to hang out together. The Olive and June Mani system is a real game changer. So visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first Mani system.
I mean, that should matter to everyone. Who holds the president responsible if he or she does something wrong? And the idea that the answer is no one is so scary to me. Tax returns or no tax returns before Election Day or not, that is a question we need a strong, not so fast, buddy. And I think that we got that from the court.
This is Sarah.
And Beth.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
the home of grace-filled political conversations.
Welcome to another episode of Pantsuit Politics. We're excited to be back with you today as we wrap up another Supreme Court term. Our Patreon page in particular has become just Supreme Court Central as Beth has begun summarizing all the cases. And we thought we would talk through a few of the big cases. The Trump tax return cases are on everyone's minds as we're sitting here recording, and talk about just the court in general and what this term means for the future of the court.
Before we dive into my favorite subject, as well as the subject that is causing me the greatest anxiety, because we're going to touch on school at the end of this episode, we want to remind you that our Extra Credit Book Club is so much fun. You can go to the Wild Geese Bookshop, which is a small, locally owned bookstore in Indiana, run by one of our favorite people, Tiffany, and sign up to receive our book subscription. Once a quarter, Sarah and I personally pick some books. Tiffany packages them up beautifully with some other fun little surprises, like this amazing heel balm this month. Mm-hmm. And you can read the books that are influencing our thinking. You can join some discussion on Facebook about them and Goodreads. It's just an excellent way for us to all be lifelong learners together.
I mean, as we have this conversation about the Supreme Court, believe we're going to reference the Federalist Papers, which is an instrumental part of our summer series coming up at the end of this month, How to Be a Citizen, and included in the Extra Credit Book Club subscription this quarter. And what's really cool is we've built this into our Patreon. So if you are a $50 supporter or a $100 executive producer, then you get the Extra Credit Book Club subscription as part of your benefits of being a patron.
So thank you to everyone who is doing that. Thank you to everyone who's involved in the book club and who is learning right along with us. And all the links for that will be in the show notes.
And you don't have to subscribe to the Extra Credit Book Club subscription to participate in the book club. We have groups on Goodreads and Facebook where we talk about all the books we've selected and have conversations and just, like Beth said, keeping that learning process going.
Well, I have been reading a lot lately, but not necessarily books, because the Supreme Court has been so busy this term. And can I just do a little moment of personal venting before we get into what's really important here?
I mean, that's usually my shtick, but go for it.
Thank you. We have a court right now with a couple of justices who just believe that they must write their own opinions on every single case. Looking at you, Brett Kavanaugh. And it's exhausting. Okay. And I have read so many words and there are so many more words to read. We're going to talk about the big decisions from today. But as we sit down to record, they have been published for exactly 1 hour. I did refresh fast enough this time to get them downloaded before the court's website crashed. So I've learned something every Monday and Thursday. But man, so many words from the Supreme Court. And I love the Supreme Court. I'm just saying, maybe you don't need to write your own opinion every time.
Have you not learned over the course of this term that you probably could skip his concurrences? Come on.
Or his dissents, because they're usually just, I agree with someone else, but I'm just here to say it on my own.
Well, let me just give you permission to skip that. And let me just tell Brett Kavanaugh, meet me at the mic. Okay, friend, I know you think that all these words are going to undo your perceived reputational damage from the confirmation hearing, but it's the opposite. Like, it's the opposite. You should keep your head down and keep your mouth shut. It's sort of like the advice Hillary Clinton got when she came to the Senate. Like, prove it by being a member of the court. Prove that you're not this screaming egomaniac that you sort of came off as during the confirmation hearings, and just do the work. And somehow he got the interpretation that doing the work is writing all the words. And that's not the case.
Even with all those dynamics, I will tell you that Brett Kavanaugh is not currently my least favorite justice to read.
Is it Alito?
That title belongs to Justice Alito. Correct.
Yeah, he's the worst. He's the worst.
So pedantic.
He just is. He is. I'm sorry. It's true.
Okay, well, we've lost everyone now in these weeds of the Supreme Court. So let's talk about the Trump tax return cases. There were two separate cases in front of the court. One of them involved a criminal subpoena from the state of New York as it continues its investigation into possible violations of business law by multiple individuals and entities. The second case was about the House of Representatives subpoena of the president's financial records. In both cases, Mazars, the entity that holds those financial records and does the president's financial work for him, said, not us, not it. We don't have an opinion here. This is between you all. Let us know what we're supposed to do. So in the criminal case, the New York case, we have the court with an opinion by Justice Roberts saying very firmly, you are not wholly exempt as the president of the United States from criminal subpoenas, whether they come from federal prosecutors or state prosecutors.
I mean, it was a bold argument the president was making in this case. I mean, I think in one of the oral arguments, not before the Supreme Court, but I think one of the lower courts, one of his attorneys argued, like, if he committed a murder, they would have to wait until the end of his term to investigate and prosecute the murder. That's bananas.
Absolute immunity is what they said the whole time. We've heard that phrase from him about all kinds of things, right? Absolute immunity. And Justice Roberts said no. And I really love that he began the opinion by talking about Aaron Burr, sir, and the trial of Burr for treason.
I mean, he's pulling out all the stops to get the Supreme Court back in favor with everyone, including, like, again, triggering everybody's Hamilton lyrics reflex.
There are so many pop culture references in the decisions this term. Justice Kagan does this a lot, too. And I think what you see with both Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan doing things like that is this love of the institution and this desire for everyone else to love the institution again, too. You know, you don't drop a Veep reference in an opinion as a Supreme Court justice casually. That is someone saying, come in with me. There's something really good here, something worth being interested in. So anyway, Justice Roberts tells us no absolute immunity, no heightened standard. President Trump is just a citizen for purpose of receiving and responding to a criminal subpoena, which also means that just like any other citizen, he can raise in state court all kinds of objections to the subpoena. But he has to do that. He doesn't just get to say, nope, I'm the president, go away. That's a really significant decision. Roberts wrote the majority. He was joined by Breyer, Sotomayor, Kagan, Ginsburg. And then there were concurrences from Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. So they agreed with the vote, but for slightly different reasoning. Then you have Thomas and Alito dissenting. They agreed with the president that he is immune from this kind of subpoena.
Here's the thing. I think this case and the other case has become all about Trump's tax records. And I think that is really important. And I think we should see those tax records before Election Day, which seems unlikely at this point. But I also think that there is a really important issue at play here. And not just sort of an elite argument or a philosophical argument about our institutions, although I think that is there and I think it's really important. I mean, I think that this is something I know is a conversation I'm having with my relatives, which is if nobody that's ever had so much as a liberal thought, the bureaucracy, the quote unquote deep state, any court, the media, if none of those people are trustworthy, then who can hold this man responsible? And, you know, I think that sometimes the way he tweets about the media can sort of feel like just a PR stunt, but it's not. They're making an argument that the president, no one can hold the president responsible. And that's a big deal to everybody, whether or not you practice before the Supreme Court or teach political science. I mean, that should matter to everyone. Who holds the president responsible if he or she does something wrong? And the idea that the answer is no one is so scary to me. And, you know, tax returns or no tax returns before Election Day or not, that is a question we need a strong not so fast, buddy. And I think that we got that from the court.
We're finally at my favorite time of year. Spring is here. Summer is just around the corner. We're getting our summer essentials ready. Our sunscreen, our emotional support water bottles, our steamy beach reads. But maybe you would prefer your steamy earbuds. This year, there is a new kind of essential right at your fingertips. Enemies to love. Chance encounters, a slow burn. Friends that become more. Whatever your favorite romantic trope, Dipsy has a spicy audio story just for you. Dipsy is an app full of hundreds of short and spicy audio stories that bring scenarios to life with immersive soundscapes and realistic characters. You can discover stories about second chance romances and adventurous vacation flings. That's my favorite. Hot and heavy hookups. It can be as heavy or as light as you want it to be. This is what I love about Dipsy. It is a modern approach to romance. Through high-quality, captivating audio fiction that you can listen to in the privacy of your own headphones. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/pantsuit. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipseastories.com/pantsuit. That's dipsystories.com/pantsuit.
I recently reorganized my closet and realized that I never need to buy a white blouse or a blue dress again as long as I live. Guys, I have plenty. I did want to add some much neglected color, like pink and yellow, to my closet, and I knew just where to go.
Quince always has timeless pieces and a true rainbow of options that can help you build a classic wardrobe no matter the season. It's getting warmer, so I got a soft pink chiffon pleated miniskirt that is so cute, and a really beautiful yellow cashmere tee. It's short-sleeved. It's perfect for the sort of bridge weather we're experiencing right now. And the best part is all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I absolutely love it. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/pantsuit for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/pantsuit to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/pantsuit. Traditionally, financial planning advice is either only for those who are already wealthy or salespeople calling themselves financial advisors who say they'll give you free financial advice but really just sell products to earn commissions. Fearless Finance takes a dramatic departure from either of those traditional models. Their entire business is built on making financial advice accessible and affordable because we know that financial literacy, stress reduction, and financial security are critical to overall well-being. I'm a little bit obsessed with Elizabeth, our Fearless Finance advisor. I've had an array of advisors in the past who answered questions like, should we be spending less on this, with evasive answers like, it depends on your priorities. Not Elizabeth. She answers with actually helpful guidelines. You're spending more than the average family of five, or I'd like to see this increase by 6%. Thank you. This is Fearless Finance's mission, to make advice affordable and accessible. You meet with your planner virtually and they charge you by the hour. You only pay for the time you use down to a quarter hour. Their planners meet with you where you are on your financial journey, no judgment. Visit fearlessfinance.com today. You can chat with a planner for free to make sure it's a good fit, and you'll get $50 off your first planning meeting when you use the code PANTSUIT. That's fearlessfinance.com and use code PANTSUIT for $50 off your first planning meeting.
I think if you ask the average person on the street in a context that is independent of Donald Trump, if the president is suspected to have committed a crime, should the president be investigated? The person would say, of course. I think we have gotten to this so silly place where people defending Donald Trump as a human, not thinking about the office of the presidency, believe that the intention on the part of anybody who didn't vote for him or anybody who did vote for him and subsequently changed their mind, that their intention is so toxic that it means who cares about all of the other standards? The only thing that matters is that I don't trust where this person's coming from. Well, here's our first Federalist Papers reference. Our whole government is built on the premise that we should not trust where anybody's coming from. We have every rule and standard in place designed with the assumption that human beings are self-interested and ambitious and untrustworthy. And that is why they need structure and rules.
Well, and just the group of people that you can't trust just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, as is defined by Donald Trump or William Barr. You know what I mean? Like, who's left? Who is left to say, you can't do that, that's wrong?
And in that way, you know, we had a conversation with some scholars from Democracy Works that you'll hear in our summer series about the court. And they said everything points to Justice Roberts as thinking so much about how to rehabilitate the court post-Bush versus Gore, that what he wants more than anything else is to restore trust and confidence in this institution. And I think this pair of decisions, as unsatisfying as they are to people who want those tax returns yesterday, and I'm among those people, by the way, the court is saying, here is the standard that should govern. Now go back through the process using that appropriate standard.
Which is really what they're supposed to do, is comment on the process, not make decisions.
I know that that feels weird. It feels like the Supreme Court ought to have the final say, meaning what's the outcome. But the Supreme Court has the final say about what the law is, Appellate courts always defer to lower courts to say what the facts are, and how the law is applied to the facts is best left in the lower courts if that's possible, because they're closest to it. So the court here says he's not absolutely immune and he should go back through this process and make whatever normal citizen arguments he's going to make about the subpoena. And courts will decide how they decide under those normal citizen arguments.
That's why the trust was lost in Bush v. Gore, because they didn't do that. They interfered in the outcome. That's why all the trust in the institution was shredded, to the point that they even said at the end of the decision, hey, by the way, this doesn't apply anywhere else, which is a real red flag if you're the Supreme Court. And I think that's what he is trying to rebuild, is that moment they took where they messed with the outcome was hugely detrimental. And so every time I think he gets the chance, and I'm not saying it's just John Roberts, but anytime I think the court gets the chance to say, you want a real easy outcome, a political outcome, that's not what we do here. And I think they do that with the House case as well, when you have an even bigger issue of separation of powers between Congress asking for subpoenas on his financial records and the president saying, absolutely not, never. And the Supreme Court being asked to get involved.
And so Chief Justice Roberts wrote that opinion, too. And I think let's reflect for a second on the fact that the Chief Justice of the court wrote both of these opinions himself.
7-2 decisions.
7-2 decisions.
I mean, it's like the last five have been 7-2, right, that have come out. I think that's important, too.
Released on the last day of releasing decisions for the term. The House decision, and which I have only read very quickly and need to go back and spend time with, agonizes over what to do when you have this kind of conflict between two co-equal branches of government, and deliberates on how you resolve that conflict, and says, basically, here's what we've got right now. Work on this, lower courts. We could see this decision come back up to the Supreme Court again several times over, I think. And I think that's appropriate because it's really hard. I think it's appropriate to think through what is owed by the president to Congress and how should a court assess a conflict there. And if you want to be mad at somebody about this, the person to be mad at is the president. Because think about what all this drama is sourced from. All of this drama is sourced from the president failing to do what almost every person who's ever sought that office has done in their campaigns. So if you think that the court didn't go far enough here, or if you think the court went too far, direct your anger at the person who is litigating the hell out of doing something that is customary, even for people who like run for governor in some states. It's just, it is mind-blowing that we ask the Supreme Court to hold all of this stuff, and then we all decide to direct our emotion at the court about it instead of the person who could have just said, okay, fine, here are my tax returns. What's in those tax returns that's worth bringing three branches of government into conflict with one another?
Oh, well, we're going to find out. I mean, we're not going to find out before the election, I don't think. But these decisions are not a long-term, quote-unquote, win for Donald Trump and him trying to protect whatever the heck it is he's so terrified of everybody finding out in his financial records. Like, I think it will come out eventually.
So, Sarah, you were commenting on the fact that these are 7-2 decisions, and I think that is really important. You want to say more about that?
Well, there's not just that. I mean, there were 7-2 decisions in the religious freedom laws with regards to contraception, healthcare coverage under the Affordable Care Act, and employment discrimination in religious institutions. And, you know, I don't really think that John Roberts walked in the room and was like, listen, y'all, we're not going to be doing any more 5-4. Because 5-4, the second people see, and listen, I'm guilty of this too. What's the first thing I check for? The breakdown. Because if it's 5-4 conservative to liberal justices, then I think this is a political decision. It's just hard not to think that way. Now, you can read them, and, you know, I think that that's why your summaries are so valuable. Because, you know, reading them and breaking them down, Supreme Court decisions are so very rarely summed up neatly in a phone notification. But for better or for worse, I think that is the mental game we all play when they come out. And when they're not like that and you see names in the majority like RBG or Sotomayor, names you know and respect and like and trust, maybe that's really what it's about. I don't know if it's just partisanship, but it's trust. Well, I don't know. I think there's less trust on the conservative side because they're so, so excited and ready and willing to turn on John Roberts at this point. But
and Justice Gorsuch, too.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I think that getting decisions that don't break down that way, if you are trying to build trust back up in the institution and show that this isn't just a simple who appointed you, how do you vote, end of story situation is, I think it's, you know, it's good. It's beneficial for the court. No doubt about it.
What I wish for every citizen of the United States to understand about the court is that every person there is playing a super long game because they're lifetime appointments. They understand what their place in history is going to look like.
Well, now, wait, I'm going to time out real quick on that. I think Kavanaugh and his infinite decisions is too consumed with the short term, is in fact not playing a long game. But everybody else, I'll give you.
That's fair. That's fair. Especially because Kavanaugh, several times this term, has agreed with the Alito Thomas kind of position, but not liked their tone, you know? And so has written separately to say, I would have said it differently.
Well, friend, you missed your opportunity to say things differently. Can I just put that on the record? You had a chance, a real opportunity to say things differently. And you missed it. Just sorry. I'm going to stop dunking on him, but it's just hard.
I don't need you to do that. I think that Kagan and Breyer are especially Kagan, Breyer, Gorsuch and Roberts are the most interesting people on the court right now because the four of them are doing this dance. And I would love to be a fly on the wall to understand how articulated or unarticulated this dance is. But the four of them are doing this dance where they are really trying to cross.
Like, do they have a group text?
Yeah. I doubt they do. Something in me says no.
But what if they did? But what if they did? Let's write that fan fiction, Beth.
I mean, don't tempt me. So I think those four are trying so hard to cross that ideological split as often as possible so that the other two will come with them when it really matters. And that's why you see in the contraception cases, you see Kagan and Breyer concurring and saying, I don't get there the same way the majority does, but I get there as to what we're saying today. And a lot of that comes down to the way the question is presented to the court. You know, the Little Sisters of the Poor case, the question is really about the power of the Department of Health and Human Services to make decisions about the Affordable Care Act. And in other contexts, people who are very angry about this decision would be adamantly pressing for the power of the Department of Health and Human Services to make regulations to implement the Affordable Care Act, right? Mm-hmm. So the justices, even though there are transparent examples of their personal, political, and philosophical decisions, for example, Justice Thomas writing the majority opinion in that case in favor of the department's power, when most of the time he says, you know, everything executive branch agencies do is bullshit and most of them shouldn't exist. So that there is that transparent personal piece. But where you have a Kagan and Breyer going forward, you know, they see that in other contexts, they're really advocating for deference to executive branch agencies. So it's just an interesting interplay. Again, cannot be captured by the alert that comes to your phone.
You know, part of what always bugs me about Clarence Thomas and Alito and even Kavanaugh, I just, there's this, well, I'm right. And I'm just going to stand here and scream about how right I am. There's no, you know, they see that it's like they see themselves just as a Supreme Court justice and not a member of the Supreme Court. You know what I mean? Like, instead of being a part of the whole and realizing that that means engaging with your fellow justices, engaging with that sort of long-term outlook and strategy. It's just, I'm just going to dig my heels in the ground and not move.
I really loved a piece of Kagan's concurrence in the Little Sisters case where she says, you know, everybody agrees that the Department of Health and Human Services can decide what types of preventive care are mandatory and what types of preventive care are not. Everybody agrees on that. The question here is really, once they decide something's mandatory, can they say it's mandatory for only certain people and that other people are exempt? That's the question that we have to wrestle with. And she says, here, the only thing the majority and the dissent have in common is their certainty about their rightness. And then she says, if I squint at the statute, sometimes I'm convinced in one direction and sometimes the other. I don't think it's that clear. And this is what I think the district courts have to grapple with. So the humility that she brought to her concurrence there, again, feels to me like plugging into that sense of the court as a collective body and maybe an example to set for other justices and how they analyze some of these harder cases, especially in the cases that are social lightning rods.
Listen, this is a hard lesson for me to learn in my own life and had to have learned through this podcast. Like, you just cannot underestimate how much trust can be built when you say, I don't think it's clear. I always trust an opinion more when they say, not so simple. I don't think it's that easy. When they roll in and are like, please, this is so easy. Oh, man, that bugs me. And I trust, like, everything out of it after that.
So the dynamics of the individual justices in this current court are fascinating to me, and I could do nothing in my life but talk about them. I think the more important dynamic for us to consider as citizens is the interplay of the court with Congress and the president. What is apparent to me over this term is that we have asked the court to solve almost every pressing problem we have as a society right now. Immigration, abortion, what to do about Donald Trump and his disregard for the law, how to interpret discriminatory laws against the LGBTQ community. Like, all of the things that we're fighting about in our living rooms, we have expected the Supreme Court to resolve for us, and it cannot do that.
Mm-hmm.
It was not designed to do that.
Well, and I do really think there's brilliance in the way particularly Roberts and Kagan and that sort of crew you're talking about say, we are going to stay focused on the government and particularly our branch of it and not the country. I think if you don't have a long history or, you know, have by requirement of your education, spent some time pondering the Supreme Court, the way they talk sometimes of like, take it up with Congress, this is not our job, can feel callous because it feels like America is, DACA recipients are suffering. What do you mean it's not your job? And I get that. I get it. But it's back to that long game. And I think if you're Kagan or you're Gorsuch or you're Roberts or you're Breyer or really any of them, then what you're saying is you have to trust me. Like, I have to stay focused on my piece of this machinery or the whole thing breaks down. Like, I cannot lose sight of my small cog, because if I do, then the whole thing goes off the rails. And I might solve DACA, or I might save this particular group. But then I lose all ability to allow our government to deal with the next crisis. You know, like, and I don't envy them. I think that's very difficult. But back to the Federalist Papers. You know, the way this puzzle is put together is not, well, we can let the executive consume so much power and Congress take a pass and just depend on the Supreme Court to save us at every turn. It's just not, under any interpretation, how it was written. I mean, you'll hear in our civic series that they were worried nobody would want to be a Supreme Court justice. That's why they made it a lifetime appointment. because it was such a, I mean, not powerless gig, but
constrained compared to everything
constrained
else.
Constrained piece of this government. And them expanding their power, which they've undoubtedly done. I mean, there's no argument that the Supreme Court has expanded beyond its role as originally written in the Constitution, as has every branch, because our country got bigger and expanded, and the federal government got bigger and expanded. But that expansion is never going to, quote unquote, fix the issues in the executive and the legislative branches. We have to demand that. All they can just do is keep saying, do your job, do your job, do your job. But the power of the congressional branch and the power of the executive branch doesn't come from the Supreme Court. It comes from the people. And so we have to demand better outcomes from those branches instead of constantly kicking it to the Supreme Court and demanding the policy outcomes we want.
You know, Sarah, I so respect everything you just said. And the other thing that I'm thinking about when you say the court is focused on its piece of the government instead of the country is a conversation I had with a really good friend of mine who, by the way, thinks that I am bananas for caring at all what is a concurring or dissenting opinion. He's like, why do you enjoy this? But his perspective, which I also agree with, is that in some ways the court is entirely focused on the country because it tends to end up right where most people would if presented with these questions in the abstract. So you think about the DACA decision. The legal analysis there is thin, in my opinion. I agree with the result, and I think the analysis is thin. I agree so much with the result that I cried when I got it. And also, I really think that was the court making an attempt to answer this question the way the majority of Americans would have. I think that's the transgender case, where I think the analysis is much better. But I also think, I mean, we talked about this. Most people thought it was already illegal to discriminate based on someone being LGBTQ. I think in these religious freedom cases, if you ask the average person on the street, should contraception be covered by insurance plans, they would say yes. Should they be covered by insurance plans if the people who provide those plans really strongly object based on their religion? I think, and people are going to be mad at me for saying this, but I think the majority of people in the abstract presented with that question would say no. And I just think the court finds a way to get there, that justices tend to move to a place that really reflects the country. That is the screaming, raging argument from Alito this term, and sometimes from Gorsuch. We're avoiding the hard question because we know the public won't like it. That's absolutely what Gorsuch said in the abortion case out of Louisiana. We're avoiding the hard question. We're avoiding the hard legal analysis because we don't think the public likes it. So it feels like thinking about the country is part of that need to think just about their piece of the government.
Well, I guess I would just say that, yes, and as you know, the sexy decisions are not the only decisions they put out. That there are so many decisions the court makes that you couldn't get the average American to make a call on because it would take you too long to explain what they're about.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that they're doing a lot more than this bubbling up in those notifications. And even when they're trying to get where the majority of America wants them to get, I think it's that, I don't think it's let me twist the law to get to the policy. I think it's an acknowledgement of the ways in which the court's power has expanded over the years. That's why that originalist, you know, let's go back to the framers' intent, always bothers me. You know that this branch wasn't supposed to be anywhere near as powerful. You can complain about Congress's expansion and the executive branch expansion all you want, but it's not the only branch that got expanded. And it feels like those decisions are more just of an acknowledgement of we're doing more than we were ever originally intended to do than trying to meet America where it's at. I just think that, I mean, maybe that's two sides of the same coin.
I also am not sure that the framers' intent was for the framers' intent to be controlling in this context, but we'll talk a lot more about that during our summer series. So consider that your nerdy teaser. Next up, we will chat a little bit about the issue causing a ton of anxiety for, I think, every American, whether you have children or not, the flashpoint of school reopening.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh, vegetable-forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never frozen meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons. If you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages, Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious. And Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It sounds like we are just swimming through the depths of political philosophy and the role of our government. It's because we are, in preparation of our summer series, How to Be a Citizen, because I think there's need for that right now. I think there is a real need and desire for deeper conversations about what are we trying to do here? What are we trying to do together as this community of citizens in the United States or in our states? And I think, honestly, another manifestation of this need for deeper conversation is right now surrounding whether or not school is going to be open in the fall, which has become quite the flashpoint, which is funny to me, Beth, because I don't know about you, but since my children stopped going to school in March, it seemed like this was going to be an important question to answer. And I don't understand why our leaders in Congress have all of a sudden decided, man, I guess we better pay attention to this when it's going to happen in like a month or so.
Well, I think the leaders in Congress are paying attention because the president has become so focused on it, because the president has just decided that the best way to keep his base organized and fired up is to speak to their current pain point. You know, school is everyone's current biggest pain point in so many ways. Mm-hmm. Maybe not biggest for everyone, but it is a huge pain point for everyone because school represents so many things. This is another institution where we've said public school, be everything for everybody. Be childcare, be education, be food security, be in some cases clothing security, be love and care that students don't get from home, be the people who can report on suspected child abuse and neglect, be it all. And so when we remove that,
while we simultaneously cut your funding,
correct, while we neglect you in every way. So when we take that out of the picture and at the same time are demanding back to normal, everybody back to work, you know, get in the cubicle and churn out 40 hours or whatever it is, we're just lost. That's how we feel right now, to me, just adrift in every way. I was sharing with Sarah before we started recording, I just can't sleep this week and nothing is particularly wrong, but everything is wrong. And I think that the school question is a big part of it, even though I know that my family will adjust to whatever happens. We will figure it out just like we did in March. But my family is uniquely situated to figure it out. And we're in a very, very small group of people.
Here is what bothers me about this whole thing. Like you said, you know, this has become such an area of focus because we are acknowledging that the economy cannot fully reopen until schools reopen. But neither of those things can happen until we can assure people of their safety. If Donald Trump did not learn that lesson from his rally in Tulsa, I don't know what will teach it to him. And just reopening to reopen only compounds the problem if you then have to close down, dial back, withdraw again. Schools and the safety of children are of such importance, but schools are not just filled with children. Schools are also filled with teachers and administrators who are and can be very at risk for exposure to coronavirus. So the question is not, should we, do we want to reopen schools? The question is, can we do it safely? And to do it safely requires a massive amount of money and time and energy. And the United States Senate has decided to, do nothing because they got some positive jobs reports about the economy and decided we're just going to see how things are going. Well, guess what, guys? Time's up. Like, we have to start making these calls soon. And their local decisions, they're going to look different. Whether or not school should be open is the first question of like 150 questions every school district is going to have to answer. And Congress, you know, House Democrats passed a bill with a massive amount of funding, still probably not enough. You know, people are estimating $200 billion to help schools do this properly, and their bill only contains $58 billion. But it's not like other places in the world haven't been able to do this with social distancing, with masks, with sanitation routines. But it takes money and resources and guidance, not us all sitting around saying, man, do we want schools to open up? Like, well, yeah, of course we do. But there's more to it than that. And just the idea that, like, well, we're just going to push for schools to be open, and the CDC's guidelines were too tough, so we're going to tell them to go back to the table and make them easier, as if that's going to, you know, make people feel less fearful, actually assure student and teacher safety, or, most importantly, produce money from the thin air so people can actually follow those guidelines, is just, it is so frustrating to me.
Here's my perspective on this as a person who, to use the title of Mary Trump's book, which I have mixed feelings about, but I think the title is genius. I know that I am too much and not enough in my sort of conservative philosophy for people. On schools, I am probably center right. As long as public schools are adequately funded, I am wholeheartedly in favor of what would go under the umbrella of school choice. The important caveat to me is that public schools are adequately funded, which they're not today, right? But putting those two things together, I feel really comfortable and good even about school choice. I also actually believe that a lot of local control in schooling is really important. I also think that there are real benefits to Common Core. So I have this weird plate of opinions about school that would annoy someone if we sat down to talk about it. And I respect that. It is a thing that we should have diverse opinions about because schools have to serve so many different kids and families in so many different contexts and communities. You know, you can't divorce a school from the community in which it sits, in my opinion. And so I look at everything the president has been saying about this topic and what's coming out of this administration about this topic. And here's what makes me really mad. I would go with them on the idea that school should be pretty localized 9 times out of 10. But why now, with the federal government mandate, what schools open in person versus go online, when we know that there are areas of this country having dramatically different experiences with this virus? Why is local control not even more important in this context than it would be in any other? This is not curriculum. This is where the rubber really meets the road on what's happening in your community. Why on this topic are we using federal funding as a threat and perhaps a stick to force schools to do what the federal government wants them to do, when people who generally view schools the way I do have rejected that in every other context? It is such an, it's another example of the complete abandonment of actual principle by this administration in service of nothing more than short-term electoral objectives. And I gotta tell you, I think they're making the wrong gamble on this. I cannot imagine who outside of that very hard floor of support the president has feels good about the way he's talking about this. We saw in Kentucky the power of teachers and people who love and care about and interact with teachers to unseat even the party that we are predisposed by every metric as a state to support in our gubernatorial race. Matt Bevin lost that election because of the way he spoke about teachers. I am convinced of it. And to talk about reopening school and cutting funding if it doesn't happen exactly the way the president wants, without concern for the health and safety of teachers and students, I just think the president is assessing the mood of the American public in a dramatically wrong way.
I mean, I just think as far as his electoral strategy, he only has one. He used it last time. It worked. He's doubling down at this time. We'll see. He doesn't have different gears. And I think that's, you know, part of probably what Mary Trump is going to argue in her book. Like, there's only one gear. There's only one mode, attack. And in a crisis, you need more than attack. And that is what we're seeing. We did want to say we're not done with this conversation. Any stretch of the imagination. On Tuesday's show, we are sharing conversations with early childhood educators, with elementary school teachers, with college admissions officers. We sat down with people in these different areas, from early education to public education to higher education, to talk about how COVID has exposed problems that have been there all along. And we wanted to really have some depth, because I think when we're talking about opening schools, I hope, I really, really hope that this conversation turns into more than how we open schools in the fall and becomes a conversation of how have we abandoned our education system and how can we revive it? And that's what we really hope to start engaging with on Tuesday's show.
Thank you for being here with us and thinking about these questions. Thank you for considering how to be citizens to the point where we feel excited to bring you a whole series on that topic. And we'll be back with you on Tuesday. Keep it nuanced, y'all.
Pantsu Politics is produced by Dylan Garvin and Studio D Production. Elise Knapp is our managing editor. Dante Lima is the composer and performer of our theme music.
Our show is listener supported. Special thanks to our executive producers, Tim Miller, Tiffany Hasler, Joshua Allen,
David McWilliams,
Allie Edwards,
Martha Brunitsky,
Amy Whited,
Janice Elliott,
Sarah Ralph,
Barry Kaufman,
Jeremy Sequoia,
Lori Ladau,
Emily Neasley,
Allison Luzader,
Tracy Putoff,
Jared Minson.
To support Pantsuit Politics and receive lots of bonus features, visit patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics.
You can connect with us on our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com, sign up for our weekly emails, and follow us on Instagram.